Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Galileo's discovery of scaling rules. I'm going to read this article by Mark A. Peterson, but in general, this sort of background research, when I've heard my friend Professor Dave is actually going to do some work in this area, and mentioning scale, overlook, and this is just part of the general thing I do. For almost everything, I sort of get onto a topic and sort of read deeply way beyond my understanding and get into it and get little aspects of it, try and retell it, get it wrong. And of course, this is part of general cognitive rehab, learning how to read, think and research. Now for this, Galileo was involved in some really Renaissance slash almost medieval fantasy of Dante's Inferno, which is a story about this lad who descends into the underworld, guided by it's sort of like a cross between Games of Thrones, I'm trying to think of the DC and Marvel comic worlds, that type of stuff going across. It really is, Dante's Inferno is really sort of the soft porn, sort of Games of Thrones stuff. And sort of the major thing is it contextualizes the Bible, which is the, sort of the main book up there, with the modern man. So the Bible doesn't have the modern, which is the Renaissance man, going in there. So it's sort of like a real mashup. Now, there's a whole heap of things going on. There's no publishing houses. Modern science is not yet being invented. It's on the cusp of being invented. And we've got this sort of crazy mixed up world going on there. Now, in terms of my own personal research, I've sort of began to read Dante's Inferno, and then I found it takes 3 hours to listen to it straight, and 13 hours on dramatic reading. So obviously there's some dramatic pauses in there, a factor of must be read very, very slowly, I must think, or there must be music interludes in the long one. But in general, I've gone through the easiest one I've gone, and I've embarrassed myself completely. Anime interpretation, which seems a little ideal. It's in terms of Dante was a Renaissance man, a divine comedy comic view of the Bible, and of course the Bible is probably inaccessible to the Renaissance man, so it's made it accessible. And this is sort of a double dip, the anime one, which I saw, because it's been made accessible to children. So it's sort of like the Bible, two levels of interpretation, and it's sort of almost hasn't got the art, the Ghibli studio stuff. Like Totoro and I wish I could remember some of the names. This is it going in, but it's all going back in and reading these things. And Professor Dave will know that this just quiet slogging away, chipping away, researching is what I've always done, coming across. And so very much in tune when I've contacted Professor Dave, he knows, very much in tune, no fuss, no bother, just quietly doing one little bit at a time, so no complicated stories or things like that. So let's sort of start to read off this one. He's Department of Physics, so he's one of us, Mount Holkey College, South Hadley, Massachusetts. So one can imagine, where is Mount Holyoke Where's that? And what? Where is South Africa? We know where Massachusetts is in the United States. But he's someone who's just quietly gone about his way and worked his way. Galileo's realization that nature is not scale invariant motivated his subsequent discovery of scaling laws. He thinks his thinking is traced to two lectures he gave on the geography of Dante's Inferno. So this is a bit of Sherlock Holmes sleuthing work going across here. Scaling laws means that essentially strength goes up as strength, and surface area goes up as the square, and the mass goes up as the cube. So if you have a rod, and if you have a toothpick, it will be strong, but if you scale it up to being 3 kilometers by five, or spatial stuff, so the basic scaling laws means it tells you why you can build a certain house, and it will, you have to get different materials to build a skyscraper as opposed to a house. So you can, if you want to, you can build your sandcastle, but you can't sort of build the a Empire State Building size type of thing. Now, bear in mind that Galileo was not around at the time of the dinosaurs. We had no evidence of these gigantic animals, but these gigantic animals did a few things in their scaling laws. We know that the Brontosaurus, that one with the long neck, had a different type of breathing mechanism, which meant that it breathed more effectively and had air sacs in its neck, so it had a very lightweight neck. And there's various things, the hollow bones, the birds, and stuff like that. Still, they were big, but not, you know, enormously big. Sort of like, they're not Godzilla size. You know how Godzilla goes up and rips down skyscrapers? No, they could go down to, say, the main street of Penrith and wreak havoc there with the three-story buildings and stuff like that. They definitely couldn't go 20 stories high, which is sort of scaling laws. And of course, this is one thing that you tend to lose in the the name escapes me. It's Adobe style, I've forgotten the name of the programs, Photoshop. Like, you can Photoshop in anything as big as you want. And scaling laws is something that, thank goodness, the human mind has not stopped, so I can scale down the sun mentally. So we sort of get people to intellectually break the scaling laws and imagine different laws of physics as we reduce the scale. So the scaling laws is really important to teaching, and this is how I got in with Professor Dave, saying, look, the scale is a really important part of teaching. We really need sort of this pocket guide, a pocket guide so you can carry scales in your pocket. And we're working along that way. That's how I got in contact with Professor Dave. Okay, Galileo's last book was The Two New Sciences, A Dialogue in 4 Days. Now, let's stop here. Sorry, I'm just going to be really slow. Now, the idea of a dialogue, I went before with a basic description here. It started off with a cult. You had to live the whole thing. Then it was condensed poems, and then it was condensed to people living and having a conversation, and then rather than videoing it, you couldn't do a YouTube. Plato was doing TikToks or YouTubes of these ideas, and he was editing them together, and he would have a play. So the Greeks used to have plays. They used to have musicians who would go out ahead of their armies and placate their enemies. And this is absolutely true. There's a story of the Athenians and the Spartans, and a musician, the Athenians sending a musician and a ballad. So, and a lot of the detailed, like, you couldn't send a not a Google, the Guardian, stuff like that would, in general, be someone with a bloody good lute and be able to sing a ballad, and everyone would listen to it. So if I just went in and said, the news of the day, blah blah, it's best to go, and everyone go to hear the lute, and then he says, let me sing you a story about this country which you really don't want to invade, and stuff like that. So that was there, and then to get the stories out, people would you know, like, if you told one person, it would be not that effective. But if you put it into a story or a book, it really went then. Now, Plato's Republic, Ship of State, there's a whole lot of famous things inside books. Now, you see this change a little bit with Aristotle. Aristotle's was the first shift from telling dialogues to actually giving you an operational manual for the world. So Plato used to, people like, it was watching the History Channel, listening to Plato. Aristotle was the first person to give manuals, and of course this was such an innovation, it lasted way up into this time and affected how Aristotle believed. So there's a lot of people who misinterpreted Aristotle, and there's this misinterpretation of Aristotle which led to the very first inklings of modern society. So a dialogue is a play, a screenshot. It's sort of like an episode, a special episode of Friends of Galileo in 4 days, you know, like the Christmas special. People would go up and read it. That's what people would read. They were, the vast majority of your audience had no formal education. You couldn't rely on education system or a notation or anything like that. People would read it, and at least they'd have some level of entertaining reading these two people going, and it'd be more the wit, the anger. That's sort of, you know, oh, I don't know, in my brain thing, I can only remember having the brain stuff, can sort of remember movies, and I say, shit, I didn't understand. I now realise that a lot of my brain has been wiped from old movies, but I now see them in a lot more detail going ahead. So people reading this dialogue in the Renaissance, a lot of the people, a lot of the dialogues was written for the patron. So the patron, if you gave a politician your scientific paper, that would be shit. But so this is a way of giving your scientific paper to the scientists and the politicians at the same time. They can read it as a play. And also interesting that when Galileo was saying, Galileo, you're keeping bloody silent, write us a book, a Pope commissioned these two worlds. And his two worlds, he had his... So if you're a writer, you have your set of characters, sort of like DC World or Marvel World or Friends or something like that. You have your cast, as a writer, you have... you own the ideas, but you also own some of the characters. So someone who you have in your dialogues can't go into someone else's dialogue. That would be theft, intellectual theft. So Galileo had Simplicio, who was someone plucked out of the Aristotelian world. This is something, again, you pick up in Dante's life, is that when you're getting characters out, you can, there's no strict continuity. You can pick someone from the ancient world and from the modern times, and you can put them together, and that's the real drama of it. Now, to us, if you had, say, a political rally, and you're talking about it here, and you say, look, and I have nonetheless the friend of Jesus Christ. You wouldn't have Jesus Christ. You had the friend of Jesus Christ who sold him the fish. Oh, he didn't sell him the fish. He sold him one fish, blah, blah, blah. And I also have Adolf Hitler here. And we would think of it as a skit. But these people weren't there. So Simplicio was from a different age. And this way you could actually contrast in this medium, this very powerful medium of the dialogue, The ideas of different ages, different attitudes, and looking at it, you can actually do a film critique of it. You can, where it's a scientific paper, you can look at graphs and did they, is it connected to the NIST standard and have they cited everyone? Here you can say, so the reason, it's sort of a bit like looking at Apocalypse Now. So, well, he was going through a very dark part of his life, and you can see part of his life in the play. Theoretically, you shouldn't be able to divine for, you know, from a scientific paper people's life. So, just the first sentence, I haven't got very far. So, it's in 4 days. Third and fourth day describes his solution to the long-standing problem of projectile motion, a result of obvious importance and the birth of physics as we know it. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Now, I should go back. That Galileo, a true Renaissance man, was there was no science out there. His was just the inkling, but it was held within a Aristotelian view. So Galileo thought that his balls would roll down the ramp. So his main thing was not dropping balls. He got a way to slow the drop of a ball, and slow the drop of a ball was with the ramp. And he would have dropped two balls on two ramps and see that they would crash at the same time. Dropping things and timing it was just too hard. So the ramps there. But he believed that things would roll on forever in a perfect way. The perfect way is that they'd roll in a circular way. So he had a whole series beliefs which were new but fitted well into the Aristotelian view. I think when Kepler wrote to Galileo, this is not in this, when Kepler wrote to Galileo, he said, look, mate, g'day, mate. I should explain that this is going to international viewers, or listeners, and for the Australians who read anything, the actual people, when you first read it, speak in a broad Australian accent. And so your initial view is that Galileo's an Aussie, Kepler's an Aussie. Mate, it's a bloody squished circle. They're ellipses they go in. I figured it out, mate. I should say you're a wanker. Everything, it's in heaven, it's got to be in a circle. Get, you're just a stupid idiot. And of course, one of the amazing things is that if you want to see people behaving badly, look no further than the Renaissance people and Newton versus Hooke. People are aghast at Newton. So Newton had a love affair with his Swiss mathematician, and it was a bit of a sook, I suppose, but he really got into Hooke. People go, what the heck? He was just a Renaissance, edge of the Renaissance, beginning of the Enlightenment person. This is what you did. You hated your enemies, and you kept your secrets, and you had your characters in your plays and stuff like that. And just as for an example, if you read the start of Principalia, the major big features was is that Newton's poem. Newton was a poet, and we didn't even know it. Newton wrote poems at the start, and so often there'd be little poetic interludes and pictures, and the really important thing was the picture at the front of your volume. If you didn't have a good picture, no one would read it. It's sort of like a comic book gone mad. So you've got this going on. So you've got projectile motion, but there's just little arguments there. Again, the edge where Galileo's coming across. Now, sort of the idea is that it's sort of like a lecture that you can imagine giving a lecture nowadays. If you do Archimedes' principle, and so Archimedes was a mathematical man. He was really the person who did a practical application of geometry. And this is where Galileo firstly began to inject maths into science. Before science was, there was a bloke who understood, and that's it, the story. So you imagine setting an exam nowadays. You teach Archimedes' principle, and then you set the exam, and none of the students can't write anything. They'd say, well, I don't know, Archimedes could fix it. And so it was reputation-based, and the knowledge was locked with a personality in the past. But it's very much like this at the today with the coronavirus things, politicians trust the scientists. They have got no idea what's going on, or they might. But it's to reflect backwards. Look, I can't quite describe it. Oh, I'm going to have to go. So the last two is about projectile motion. And so no equations, no diagrams, no publications. It's just stuck away in a film play. It's only the second of his new scientists, but what is the first one? Da-da-da-da. And of course, this is discovery of scaling laws, so what could it possibly be to use? Two new scientists begins in the Venetian arsenal, the shipyard of the Republic of Venice, with the discussion of the effect of scaling up or scaling down the practical construction projects like shipbuilding. Now, this is sort of like the President of the United States talking in front of the picture of, you know, his things with columns and white solemnity, or standing on an aircraft carrier, and the idea, like the United States building bigger and bigger aircraft carriers, just eye-wateringly big, expensive national GDP, saying, we don't have aid for your little country, but look at this huge, mighty big navy that came across. So the Venetian army arsenal is sort of like, you set a scene a bit like Tom Jones. He was in Top Gun. This is the memory stuff. But you know how people in the United States like to dress in naval uniform and look really seriously, and they like to walk out of helicopters and that type of stuff. You know, this is really serious, and you always need that, your vice president standing behind you when you talk. I'm just trying to think, Tom. Oh, gosh, is it Tom? I think I've got that wrong. Come to me, he's a Mormon, not Mormon, he's a Church of Scientology guy. Married Nicole Kidman. There you go, that's a name I can't remember. Cannot remember his name. There you go, that's insight. I can remember physics and science, but a lot of the ideas I have are just in front of me. It's like the concept is there, but it's sort of like a bubble of thought. I can't get into it. So, people know who I'm talking about. Okay. This discussants include Galileo's closest friend, Giovanni Francesco Segredo, and Filippini Salvanti, and an Aristotelian philosopher called Simplico, who is perhaps Galileo's friend and sometimes adversary, Cesare Cremonoli. So Cesare is not of Caesar. I think this means chick. No, I don't know. Chickpea. But look, the important thing is, although he's never identified by a real name, so essentially this is the entire thing, to make something relevant and entertaining. They've got none of these rules. You can get people from different ages just popping up together, just to mix it. And people don't go, oh my God, that's not real. People go, whoa, you mean you got Hitler to the wedding? You got Pol Pot to speak? How did you do that? He's been dead for years. It happened, mate. Okay, it's not quite along those lines. Simplicio is a way of people Now, the great thing is, rather than saying so-and-so is stupid, you get your person you want to put down as in fiction to write an argument, and they go, oh, I'm wrong. And then people reading it can't tell the difference between the fictional person and the real person. I think the real person has actually lost face. Okay. It is unlikely, but not impossible, these three men actually met in life. Well, I think that's a fair statement. As Sagredo was a nobleman in Venice, Cromoli was a professor of philosophy in Padua. Now, Padua and Venice, I think that's a doable train ride. A Salvati, a nobleman from Florence, and patron of Galileo, may have been Galileo's students in Padua. This is a classic theme, that you tutor enough of them do badly, you forget about them. The ones that do good, you use to leave yourself up in future. The dialogue is in a form not intended to represent a real meeting, but rather to provide a framework for developing ideas in a lively, engaging way. So this is the entire, it hasn't changed from Plato. The conversation of the first day wanders into a dazzling variety of topics, but on the second day, following a day-long digression, it returns to a serious analysis of scaling, especially in the context of strength of materials. Now, this is... the first day is to get anyone in. Sort of at the start of a show... the rabbit comes out of the hat, and so majority of people find, oh, this is really big, and this is sort of telling you, this is sort of like the to sell the credentials, and now it's sort of like the warm up acts to get a wider variety of people in listening to it. Okay, a serious analysis of scaling, especially in the context of strength of materials, according to the publisher's foreword. It is this topic that should be understood as the first of the two new scientists. It was the publisher, not Galileo, who gave the book its title, and Galileo was unhappy with it. It's sort of like a director and publisher. The publisher is not necessarily the person. There's a printer, but the publisher is someone who's into marketing. Perhaps because it seems irrelevant to much of the ingenious speculation of the first day. It is clear, though, that Galileo did assign enormous importance to the problem of scaling and the strength of materials, an importance that modern readers have found more than a little puzzling. And what? Right. Okay. It's sort of like introducing all these hot babes, and then they go off and play golf, or something like that. It's like a golfing movie. Oh, what? I will show that... that the key to much of this strange, that what is strange into new two new scientists, is found to be two rather neglected early lectures given by Galileo on the shape and location and size of Dante's Inferno. So, Dante's Inferno is this dude goes into the underworld, and he sort of mentions a few clips. Now, I have to go a bit about it. The text of these lectures is readily available in the standard 20-volume opera of Galileo among the literary writings in Volume 9. My reconstruction of its actual significance, which is not at all literary, in the subject of this paper. Okay, well, this is what it is about. And, of course, can I say, reading... reading Latin is just eye-wateringly hard. So, being of Xavier College, a Catholic upbringing, I did learn Latin, and enough schoolboy Latin, I think, with the help of Google Translate to get things out. And there is some real interesting aspects to reading things in Latin, because you realise that they can't possibly, when they say that multiply, they don't have the word multiply, they don't have a lot of algebra is not in Latin. So this is one of the major things, is that we had to move out of Latin. So Newton didn't have multiplication, okay, because it has conjugation it's got a more group theory story for it, I think. Okay, chapter 2 of this paper, section 2, scaling in the two new sciences. So remember that the idea of when Galileo wrote it, he wrote it as something as in the Renaissance person mind, and now, which is purely in the context of his society, where his publishers are beginning to look more internationally. So this is on the cusp of things moving, so the publisher comes in and holds it together as sciences. The two new sciences begin on the subject of scaling. So calling it a science is what people want to buy. Galileo's observations on scaling are in general ingenious and elegant and entirely deserving of a prominent place he gives them. These ideas are basic in physics and are introduced into most introductory physics texts under the heading of dimensional analysis. I don't think so. We could even say that modern renormalization group methods are just one of the recent ways to deal with the problem of scale, still recognizably in the tradition pioneered by Galileo. And this is Neumann's renormalization. I'm just still trying to get into that, Professor Dave. It is true that Galileo didn't have the algebraic notation to do dimensional analysis the way we do, but his insights within a strict arena are the same as ours. Well, yeah, as you read into it, he still has... You've got to understand... Well, you don't have to understand, but understanding that Aristotle had four causes. First two causes are the form and the shape, and you fill it with a material... And fill it with the property of material. So it's a bit like injection molding. You have everything is somehow injection molded to come across. I'll have to go back and read the four causes. And so that's still in the idea. There's sort of like a geometry. They've got a surface area and injection molding with matter, material. Of such insight is the surface of small solids is comparatively greater than the larger one, which is all nanotechnology. Because the surface goes like the square of the linear dimension, but the volume goes like the cube. Thus, as one scales down macroscopic objects, forces on the surface, like viscous drags, become relatively more important, and the bulk forces, like weight, become relatively less important. But I think, yes, but I think there's other, there's sort of scaling factors in fluids. Like the Reynolds number, it's amazing, which I don't think this author has picked up. Galileo uses the idea of the first day, I'm trying to remember that person. Galileo uses the ideas of the first day in the context of resistance to free fall as an explanation why similar objects of different sizes do not fall exactly together, but the smaller one lags behind. Well, there you go. Even though the idea is completely general, most of the discussion on scaling is directed. So, there you go. I don't know if you've seen the famous Apollo 16, the Falcon dropping in air. Galileo is fully aware of the scaling and viscous drag and stuff like that. And he... if you read about Galileo, it's like it's factor nagging wife, old career, blah 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 blah. Concepts on that. I'll use a cannonball. The cannonballs are the sort of the ball bearings that the like they're super common back there. Obviously, if everyone's blasting the stuffings out of each other with cannons, there's lots of cannonballs around. You can imagine, but the sort of cannonballs are sort of like the milk down at the service station, they're everywhere. Specifically to the strength of materials, the subject is introduced immediately in two new sciences, the assertion that large ships out of the water would break under their own weight, something that is not a concern with small ships. The same subject occupies most of the second day. which is devoted to the strength of beams. The question is put in an especially paradoxical way to Scalia, who says, now, can I say one? If I can say one thing I have discovered, is cakes. The scaling law of cakes. I have had complete disasters building birthday cakes before. I've been, you know, I can't do them anymore. I would build these huge ones and they would completely collapse. Okay. Now, this is a quote from Sagredo, which is one of his... Now, this is the same thing of Dante's Inferno, is you just mish anyone you want. You just put them in its characters and put words in their mouth. Now, because mechanics has its foundations in geometry, where the mere size cuts no figure, I do not see that the properties of circles, triangles, cylinders, cones, and other solid figures will change with their size. Therefore, a large machine should be constructed in such a way that its parts bear to one another the same ratio as a smaller one, and if the smaller is sufficiently strong for the purpose of which is designed, it will not... I do not see why the larger should not be sufficiently strong. Okay, he's added that sufficiently. It's a remarkable argument. It combines the fact that physics is geometry and, two, scale invariance of theorems of geometry. So, physics is geometry, but you can't do physics with scale invariance. For the purpose of the paper, we'll call Sagredo's theory scale invariance. Two new scientists modified Sagredo's theory of scale invariance. Specifically, Galileo adds material properties one above, while still preserving the essential geometrical nature of physics. As Salvati puts it, much later on the second day, so the second day is when he's been, oh my god, I'm just wrong. The forces and resistance moments and figures, etc., may be considered in the abstract, dissociated from matter or the concrete associated with matter. Hence, the properties which belong to figures are merely geometrical and non-material, must be modified when these are filled figures with matter and therefore give them weight, which is the Aristotelian view, the two causes, the first cause, the form and substance, form and matter, two causes, there are four causes, something to do with the cause of what it does and what you do to make it. The other course, I'll have to get back into it. These modifications break scale invariance, but they do not change the essence of the theory. Quote, since I assume matter is unchangeable and always the same, it is clear that there is no less able to treat a constant and invariable property in a rigid manner than if it belonged to a simple and pure mathematical. So this is Aristotelian views of what matter is. So they don't have mass. Now, it's interesting, the story of mass. It's got almost a similar story to scale invariance, but it was... something of Rome. Giles of Rome. I was about to say Gerald invented mass, and he was he was also sort of strung out across Aristotle's craziness. So your mass was invented by a priest. There you go. Way before this story. A typical example of the new considerations that arise, quote, when we, quote, we fill the figures with matter, unquote. So that's the idea that everything is injection molded with matter. Starts with the breaking of a wooden beam. If the beam breaks, it's the longitudinal fibres that break. And because the number of fibres is proportional to cross-section area of the beam strength is withstanding longitudinal pull should be proportional to cross-sectional area. If a supported beam is subject to a transverse force, however, the associated torque must be balanced by the first moment of the stress in the fibres, which introduces an additional factor, the diameter of the beam. Thus, the beam strength in withstanding the transverse force should be proportional to the diameter cubed. That is, that your cross-sectional area times the length is... Now, you've got a bigger weight now. If the beam is made longer, the torque due to the same transverse force applied to the geometrical similar proportion is proportionally greater, and the beam is proportionally weaker, and so forth. Then follows Galileo's very famous observation as to why animals cannot simply be scaled up, but rather their bones must become proportionally thicker as they get larger, which is why chickens should remain the size. They're a good family meal, and they're a lot of meat, and not such bone. I shouldn't say that much. Sorry for all you vegetarian out there. All the discussions is developed in a series of 8 propositions and geometrical proofs. It is clearly the geometrical framework which makes these scalings laws a science. Can I say this is remarkable? Because yesterday I read this and my recorder was off. I'm reading it a second time. It's much easier to read. It shows there's some brain thing happening. After the 8 propositions, the discussion on animals, certain more detailed questions are considered, such as the problems of locating the weakest point of a beam, that is, where it would break, and the problem of finding a beam that would have no unique weakest point, but would be equally strong everywhere. The last of these topics are clearly separate from the original scaling theory of 8 propositions. They come after it, as applications of it, and they are not numbered, as they have been added at a later time. These topics arise naturally when one juxtaposes scaling theory with Aristotle's questions of mechanics, as Galileo points out. Now, what I was going to say here is the number of numbering of ideas is a scholastic, medieval idea of propositions. I have a series of propositions. You even get with Bohr's postulates. It's a medieval way done by St. Thomas Aquinas, and that's where you put up your propositions, put up your arguments, and it's sort of like lining up an army of arguments to do battle, and you sit back and you watch. The person is not expected to interact, they're expected to watch a masterful display. It's like the characters are cast coming out. A persistent oddity on the second day is the continuing preoccupations with the beam that break under their own weight, the same phenomena which began under the whole discussion of the Venetian arsenal, except it was their ships that break under their own weight. Another oddity is the sudden change of subjects on the first day. The conversation, which had just barely gone underway, about the strength of ropes made of fibres, but a question of non-fibrous materials is raised, such as metal or stone. But they don't make, back then, they don't make ships out of metal, and they don't make them out of stone. So this is Simplicio, who is your ring-in from an earlier age, wants to know what gives. What gives? That would be sufficient. Hey, what gives would be an Australian way of talking about it. So, Professor Dave, I'm educating all these people overseas to speak in Australian, and so you'll go on, eventually you'll get back on a flight, travel a long way, and I'll start to speak Australian to you. They'll say, what gives? Such materials, their strength. Just before this, and perhaps intended to motivate it, we had read about marble column broken under its own weight. Although Salvati hesitates to take time to discuss this, Segreta says, but if by digression we can reach a new truth, what harm is there from making one now? Okay, isn't that beautiful? It allows half thoughts and brain storms to come out on paper. And the conversation goes off the rest of the day onto speculations about the atomic theory of matter, cohesive force among atoms, and questions about infinitesimally small, infinitely large, among other subjects. The discussion is diffuse but occasionally brilliant, even if nothing is definitive can be said about what holds matter together. Now, the important thing that I want to say here, it's only recently with Photoshop and computers and big screens that we, and microscopes and stuff like that, which we can imagine things getting bigger. So one of the things is that those people can imagine a bigger thing, but they can't imagine themselves being bigger or smaller viewpoint. It's a viewpoint which, if you read into it, you just say it's, you only have to read it a number of times to realise that these people don't have microscopes, they don't have computer screens, they don't have scalings, things. Galileo, his main thing was that when they looked through the telescope, they feel they didn't think the image was getting bigger. They thought they were getting closer. It was a way of to actually go through these people, the Venetian princes and all that type of stuff. One of the important things is that they did not think when they looked through the telescope that they were getting, that it was making it bigger. They thought they were getting closer to it. So it's equivalent to, I don't have to send a ship out to that close to look at it. So that's an important thing. So the opening lines of the second day confirm, however, that the central purpose is to apply the scaling figure to all solid materials, not just fibrous materials like wood. Taking everything together, there is an odd hint of a problem in the background that motivates all discussions in the first 2 days, but it's never actually stated. Some objects of stone or metal that break under their own weights when scaled up. This unspoken problem is the conversation seems to be circling around without never quite saying so. This is someone really onto something. And this is the entire thing where often I will say, go in and see a cinema thing, and I'll say, you know what I think, and people will just throw everything at you. Like, I don't know if you watched Madagascar with the that lion. Oh, I know Melbourne's giraffe, was it? And stuff like that. But set in Madagascar. But the thing is that they land in Madagascar and a plane has crash landed into a tree. And I said, oh, that's a bit September 11-ish type of set. Yeah, of 2001, September. That's a bit crap. And this is a whole play out of an American invasion force in a foreign country trying to do good. And I got so panned for this. And this is what you do when you've got a play. You can reinterpret it many things. In seeking to understand what two sciences is really about, we recall how it came to be written. Galileo was remarkably reticent about publishing before the Starry Messenger. So we all know what the Starry Messenger is. Again, the word Starry Messenger was the publisher got in to sell the book. It's all about selling it. And so you've got these Renaissance people who are purely about building defensive ideas within. They really didn't care about the rest of Europe. So Europe was becoming a bit of a publishing house in 1610, the year. And so it turned out that we've just got the printing press going. The year he turned 46, he had published hardly a thing. Now, or I have to say, we've got the printing press. We now have the silicon printing press and micro machines. There you go. And yeah, we can see this printing masks up and face masks and ventilator parts. Yeah, you know, people are just going in their 3D printing machines around the world, printing, you know, sharing how to print parts. His astronomical discoveries that year brought him instant fame, and he parlayed his fame with his appointment to the mathematician philosopher, the Grand Duke of Tuscany. So Galileo himself is still focused in the Renaissance world. He's got no idea of the scientific publication world. In negotiation leading up to that appointment, he has described many of his books that he wanted to leisure to write based on the research. He'd been quietly doing Padua, but these books did not appear. His life in Tuscany court was fraught with controversy, and his books he actually wrote were in relation to events and new discoveries, the discourse on bodies of water, and the sunspot letters. Now, sunspots, again, was a really major problem, because how can you have a spot on the sun if the sun's put up there by God? God's made a mistake. You know, what the heck's going on? But this reminds me of any academic. They get into, they're not quite on the thing, they get into a faculty, they get involved in the faculty politics and they just lose the plot. When the Holy Office declared the opinion of Copernicus formally heretical in 1616, Galileo's fondest project was closed off to him. He silenced himself for several years, and when he finally wrote again The Essayer, after much pressure from his friends, it was in part a testy controversy that made him new enemies. Okay, I just want to go 1616. Okay, well, 1616 was okay. 1601 is when Bruno got flamed in front of the outside the Sistine Chapel in St. Peter's Square, which is okay. But there's so much more to the Bruno story. Bruno, the church, the story of the church being against Copernicus is just so wildly inaccurate, and the idea of people just do exactly the same thing that Galileo is doing with these two sciences. They suddenly have the Spanish Inquisition as the Italian Vatican Inquisition, two totally different beasts. The debacle over the great dialogue concerning the two. Am I just recording? I think I am. It's got recording there. I can't see. Unfortunately, I've got to hold my microphone in. I've got a rubber band, and the rubber band's covering the amount of volume. The debacle of the great dialogue concerning the principle of two worlds. So this is the one that got him under house arrest, and this is the where he got into trouble using this very fluid thing of writing dialogue. So this is also a dialogue, except the disastrous trial of 1633 should have ended his career, yet in his old age he somehow found the strength to begin writing or become the two new scientists. And somewhere in his past he drew the scaling theory and placed it first. Okay, so, you know, he's spared, put on ice. Now, you've got to understand the papal stuff. The papal was, it's sort of like, they're sort of a weak papacy. You needed so much support. It's sort of like Sydney lockdown drinking hours, you know, how they tried to close the pubs up in Sydney and all the music venues. And so the church was letting through, that they were, if you just ran the Inquisition hard on, it would backfire. So they were letting some things in, some things out. I can't see how Dante's Inferno didn't get the Inquisition straight on. I would just say flagrant heresy. Sort of like Bible porn, just awful. Okay, so he writes two new sciences, and what's he doing? He's obviously not going for his career. I don't know whether his wife's alive. He's just been held there, but it's sort of like he's almost been pensioned off. Just where the scaling theory came, but he was actually friends with the Pope, so he was. He'd made enough connections not to be thrown out. Just where the scaling theory comes from is a bit mysterious because there are few surviving references to it. However, it is certainly complete by 1612, the year that publishes the Defense and Discourse on Bodies of Water. The most vexing problem that Galileo deals with in there is the problem of thin lamina of material denser than water, which is nonetheless floats on the surface, supported by surface tension, as we would say now. So this would be like a pin, or, you know, your famous paperclip, which you can do. At the very end of the discourse, Galileo points out that lamina were supported by its perimeter, thin sample, so square fixed thickness. It would be more easily supported if it was cut into smaller squares because of reducing size, the area of each piece, and hence its weight, which goes faster than the perimeter, which is the source of its support. Galileo presents an argument purely hypothetically as to contrary to the fact, because his own idea of what supports lamina is quite different. Peculiar details aside, it suffices for our purpose that this reason is an explicit use of scaling theory as 18 to 1612 go on. So it's been held there, and he's got it in there to understand what's going on. And here's a quote. Okay. Even earlier reference, although not explicit, occurs in a letter from Galileo to Antonio de Medici of 1609. So the Medicis are your Kardashians of your Renaissance. This remarkable letter, in effect, at one page outline of the two new scientists almost 30 years before it was printed, Galileo describes his most recent investigation, saying, quote, I can't do an Italian accent, and as one realizes, all people throughout history, including Christ and other things, have an Australian accent, quote, and just lately I have succeeded in finding all the conclusions with their proofs pertaining to the forces and resistances of pieces of wood of various lengths and sizes and shapes, and by how much they would be weaker in the middle than at the ends, and how much more weight they can sustain if the weight was distributed over the whole rather than concentrated in one place, and what shape would have to be in order to equally strong everywhere. Which science is very necessary in the making of machines of all kinds and buildings, and which has never been treated. So there we go. This is sort of pretty amazing. But bear in mind that he's writing to Medici, so he's got to put in big claims by anyone. Okay, so this is, he's putting big claims in. He possibly can do it. He then goes on to describe certain insights into motion and projectiles. His letter then takes a clear basic organisation of the new scientists. That's already in mind in 1609, and even seems to say that the results were in some at that time quite fresh. On closer inspection, though, one sees the detailed results described in the letter belong to the last section of the second day, building the basic results on the first eight propositions, which must therefore have been even earlier material. The projectile still was still incomplete at this point, and so it comes later in the two new scientists suggest, which is plausible in any case, that the order of treatment of the two new scientists is chronological. That is, the scaling theory comes first, and because it was literally first, and we will have to look for earlier to find it. Okay, so this is reasoned thought. It's a bit spooky that this person's really got into the mindset of what's going on. The way that he's constructing it is sort of like a character analysis. I'm just trying to think of these, again, the names. He's like a film critic, and there's a very famous film critic up here in the Blue Mountains. I wish I could remember his name. I can see his face. And this is the whole thing with this brain thing. The knowledge is there, but the actual links into it, I can't get his name. Oh, I'm not going to switch off this and search it out. Very famous. There was the Margaret Pomerantz, and the other person I know really well because I write to him. I can't remember his name. So I can see his face, got all facts about him. But that piece of information. So if you can imagine sort of a data set and someone has cut out or burnt out a region around that data set, I can't access it. And so I have to pull back and let go. But really, he's like a film critic. Okay. The next suggestion for the origin scaling theory might come from the two new sciences itself. The opening scene is in the Venetian arsenal. It's particularly effective. Why not take it at face value? Galileo was obviously familiar with the arsenal, and it's known that he was consulted there of ship design. What likelier place could there be to encounter problems of scales and just where he says? This assumption would place the origin of scaling theory as early as 1592, the year he became professor of mathematics in Padua. On closer reading, though, one sees that even Segre is surprised by the failure of scalene variance in the shipyard. Salvati is not. He is already understands it and is immediately ready to explain it to Segreta. What the scene really says is that Salvati's mind, read Galileo's, was already prepared to understand what he saw in the arsenal because he had done the scaling theory. This means great search sustaining the theory still earlier, at the beginning of Galileo's career, or perhaps even earlier than that. So you can imagine it's hard to get an idea that you pick up any ancient book of ancient stuff, most of it's drivel. The worst is letters to there's a very famous Latin book, I can't remember the name, letters to it's really hurting me. This is a very famous Latin book which has been translated, and it's letters to I can't remember what it is. But when you read it, it's just instructions, handwritten, drivel instructions to slaves, close the door, put the cat out, put out the milk, not that kind of stuff. Leviticus, letters to Leviticus. So a lot of these books, a lot of these things you read and you go, what the heck? Yeah, it's just white people in monks just copied everything. It's all like, basically you've got to keep your monks busy, as far as I was concerned. Okay, section 3, the lectures on Dante's Inferno. Okay, bear in mind that this is Bible porn. Galileo enrolled in the University of Padua to study medicine at the age of 17 and dropped out at the age of 21. He spent the next several years studying mathematics independently, especially Euclid and Archimedes, and did tutoring in mathematics while living at home. Okay, it's like a typical home student. You can imagine that. But, you know, it's living at home with the plague. Well, this is interesting, sort of reading this, how these people dealt with the plague in Britain and all that stuff. Assisted his father in remarkable experiments on the pitch of plucked strings under no intention. So, this father was a mathematician person, just, you know, hang around, help me, Galileo. You'll go far with this. But the story is that this was, you know, this plucking strings was the idea that you could even question Pythagoras and the ancients. The idea was that perhaps there's more, the ancients weren't quite right. So the Pythagoras came up with the string theory. The string theory. 50 years later, he briefly summarized the experiments and the results of two new sciences on the first day. He proved some theorems, like the center of gravities in the styles of Archimedes, at the end of his life, also included those in the two new scientists as an appendix. It's clear that the two new scientists contain some very early material. There you go. So it's you can see this person always producing mathematical proof of the set, expanding it out, slowly trying to move the boundary back. The young Galileo hoped to make a reputation in mathematics with his theorems and sent a number of to Italian mathematicians. Who else would you send them to? I don't think there were any. There was no Australian mathematicians there, mate, at the time. He was fortunate to receive a favourable reply from Guidobaldo del Monte, Inspector of Fortifications, the Duke of Tuscany, someone in a position to help him. They corresponded. When the chair of mathematics of Pisa became open, someone probably Guidobaldo, but perhaps his even more illustrious brother Francesco, who had been just made cardinal, arranged for Galileo to be invited to address the Florentine Academy to give two lectures on the mathematical topics. It was in effect a seminar and job interview. Galileo's lectures charmed his audience. Within a few months, the young dropout was a professor at the mathematics at Pisa. I just wanted to work out that, you've got your Padua, which is probably Monash, you'd say Melbourne would be Florence, I don't know what Rome would be Sydney University. Pisa would probably be Ballarat, the University of Ballarat, or the the University of Traralgon, a TAFE. Sorry, mate. Okay. Galileo's audience at Florentine Academy was not a mathematical one. The Florentine Academy was a creation of the Medici dynasty. Okay, Medici dynasty. So the Florentine Academy would be like Gold Coast Bond University, which was dedicated to nobility only in the immediate previous generation, and had one of its chief functions the glorification of the Medici in every intellectual arena. So, yeah, you know, I just can't quite describe it. We've got the university, bits of the University of Western Sydney, lots of Labour Party strongholds from Whitlam era. It was far more important for Galileo to play to this predilection of his audience than to display a mathematical erudition. It was even an event he brilliantly combined a clear exposition of mathematical with the topic Florence loved to hear, the great poet Dante, and in particular the geometry of Dante's Inferno, based on the evidence of his poem. Now, to understand that the Medicis were really powerful, the Medicis had a pope involved, and they liked it. Sort of like that Dante is sort of like on Netflix. And if they thought that it was real, remarkably, Mr. President, it is real. Okay. Although Galileo did introduce certain original material in his lecture, he did not call too much attention to it, and represented himself rather as describing two previous rivals' attempts to determine the plan for hell. And one of these was Santino Mentetti, Mentetti. Sorry, Australians cannot produce, or I think Australians can, but I can't. Who was represented as a member of the now deceased Florentine Academy itself? Let me reread that one. As a member, okay, so he's a good guy. So he's sort of like Lee Matthews from Hawthorne, or something like an old Kevin Bartlett from Richmond. You know, he's a good old thing. Galileo begins in this way and seems even-handed, but as the second lecture proceeds, he becomes more and more sarcastic about. The other plan, a later attempt, was by Alessandro Evolinto, not a Florentine. Galileo begins in a way that seems even-handed, but as the second lecture proceeds, she becomes more and more sarcastic about Valento's plan until, in the end, he seems to be defending. So, Valento, I don't know who's an unpopular. Don Scott was an unpopular Hawthorne player, or he was from Collingwood. I don't know what your Collingwood players are. So, for overseas unit readers, I'm quoting from Australian Football Code, AFL, defending, page 8. Coming across here. The virtuous Florentine Mentini against the ridicule of a stupid, thoughtless Valento, to the delight of the audience, no doubt. This is like watching a grand final replay. This was now how the Medici's intellectuals should defend the honour of Florence. Only the large-scale feature of the plans that concerned us here, Mentelli's Inferno, is a cone-shaped region of the Earth with its vertex at the centre and the base on the surface, centre in Jerusalem. But because Galileo is a master of exposition, it lets him describe it. What I was going to say is the Aussie Inferno, I think I may have mentioned this before, the death-defying dome of death, sort of like, this is a from Lennox Circus. It's like death-defying dome of death. The Inferno, it's an inferno, but it's actually frozen solid in the centre. So this is the Inferno, like, go figure, sort of like doomed for consumption by Western Sydney. Quote, imagine a straight line which comes from the centre of the Earth, which is also the centre of the heaviness in the universe, to Jerusalem, and an arc which extends from Jerusalem over the surface of the water and earth together to be a 12th part the greatest circumference. So this is like, you've got a segment, so 12, so you divide it into 60 degrees is 6, a 12th is a quarter of, oh no, half, it's 15 degrees, it's a 15 degrees segment. Okay, I'm so stupid. Now, I used to be able to do huge, just do all the mathematical equations in my head and astound students, but I can't do that anymore. Blood oath. Oh, earth. Which will terminate on the with one of its extremities on Jerusalem, and from the other, let the second straight line be drawn to the centre of the earth. We'll have the centre of the circle contained by two lines, which come from the centre of the said arc. And let us imagine, then, the line joins Jerusalem with the centre staying fixed, and the other line of the arc should be moved in a circle, that such motion should go cutting the earth, and move itself until it returns to where it started, and there be cut from the earth as part like a comb, which, if we imagine, is to be taken out of the earth, and there will remain a place where it is, was a hole to form a conical surface. And this is the inferno. So this is basically, so you've got the material, earth material. As an aside to the mathematically adept, Galileo gave the volume of this region, which he knew from his study of Archimedes. And so what's the volume of a cone? I don't know if it's a sphere or something like that. The various levels of Manetti's inferno are regularly spaced. For the most part, the eighth of the radius of the earth between the levels and the next. But there are 9 levels. Oh no, the bottom level is the very bottom. It must be very pokey down the middle of the bottom. The first level, limbo, is the depth of an eighth of the radius of the earth below the surface. The shell of the material down to this depth forms a cap of the thickness of the roof of a hill. The Latino's inferno, by contrast, is much smaller, located near the centre of the earth, only about a tenth of the radius of the earth's height, making it, as Galileo is to say, ridiculously small. Only, so that's actually a fair amount of material there. Ridiculously small, only 1,000th the volume of Mantendi's. Near the end of its presentation, Galileo says, quote, here's Galileo, you bring on. Remember, Galileo was an Australian. This is breaking news. Here he is speaking for the first time. You can hear it. I've just tuned into him. I had a little MP3 player at the thing. Here one might suppose that the inferno cannot be so large as Mantetti makes it, since, as have suspected, it does not seem possible that the vault covers the inferno could support itself and fall into the hole, being so thin as necessary if the inferno comes up so high, and especially beyond being no thicker than the eighth part of the radius of the earth, which is 450 miles, more or less. It must be removed from the space of the grotto of the uncommitted. So there's the people, there's limbo, the grotto of the uncommitted is in limbo. So this is where people who just go, we would have been Christian if you bloody well told us about, we're in the wrong part of history, wrong spot on earth. This is where we are. I shouldn't say that. And even more was removed on top for a very great depth of sea. One answer is easily that the thickness is more than sufficient for taking a little vault, which is to have an arch of 30 brachias, so that's your metre. So remember, they don't have It will need a thickness of about 4 brachias, which is only enough. But even if you use just one brachia to make an arch of 30 brachias, and perhaps just half, not 4, it would be enough to support itself. And knowing the depth of the sea is very few miles, or better, even less than 1 mile, if we believe most expert sailors, assigning many miles as seems necessary to the grotto if uncommitted. A determined measure of not being by the poet is if together with the depth of the sea comes to 100 miles. Said vault will still be very thick and far more than necessary to hold it up. Because of Galileo's units, the Earth radius is about 320 miles. Okay, now, if it's 6,000 and he's got 320 miles, which is probably, I don't know, 4,000 kilometres, he's out by two-thirds. An eighth of that is 400 miles. It's clear that he's describing a scale model at the roof of the Inferno, including a certain anteroom hollowed out, a scale of one brachia to about 100 miles. The normal man is 3 brachias tall, so the model suggests that the large dome roof, somewhat smaller than the famous Broccia dome of Florentine Cathedral, as Galileo says, is less than 4 brachias thick to support itself beautifully. Which is convincing army of the Metelli model can support itself, but only if you realise the accurate assumed scale invariance. Can you really scale it up by a factor of 100,000? Absolutely not. So the roof would fall in. So, getting the absolutely not scaled up version. Is effectively equal by an enormous factor, which would immediately collapse under its own weight. So, IV discussion. Sorry. Galileo realised its mistake shortly a time later. It must have struck him like a lightning bolt. In fact, this is just how Sgro reacts to the strange emotional language at the beginning of The Two New Scientists, when Salvati asserts that nature is not scale invariant. My brain reels, my mind, like a cloud momentarily illuminated by a lightning flash, is for an instant filled with an unusual light which now beckons me and suddenly mingles with my obscure, strange, crude ideas. DM. We need look no further to know why the problem of scaling and strength materials had such urgent means to Galileo. There is nothing hypothetical about this suggestion. It is clear record with no ambiguity in it at all. He had made a gigantic blunder in the Inferno lectures sufficient to turn his whole argument on its head, and with his claim to be an intellectual champion of his country and his sovereigns to whom his young career depended. Whereas, nowadays, if you make a bloody mistake, made a mistake. I suppose it depends how much. Like, these were just, I hate to use the word wankers, weren't they, all of them? So this is, I don't know if you read the Quantum Astrologer. In these times, you'd have people, like, the science was a consumer, the only thing was popular science. You could, the only magazine published was popular science. And there was no necessary, you had to, there's no publishing of science. People had careers and they would stand up and fight to be the greater intellectual great. And people wouldn't understand that they would get the ideas. Did you win that argument? Sure, mate, I did. The other person is complete stuffed. And let me read you a play about what this person actually said. So you can imagine this bizarre double standard of propaganda going around the place. It would be insane. It may be difficult from a modern point of view to take Sgro's overwrought words seriously, yet the situation is serious enough apparently to force Galileo to concentrate on the scaling problem and develop a new theory almost immediately, to judge from his numerous internal clues. Then, instead of publishing the theory, he kept it to himself for almost 50 years. The delay is baffling if we ask ourselves only how we might have acted. Rather, we must ask how the intellectual of Galileo's time would have acted and why. Lectures themselves were evidently a success, so what is the crisis? Here we note that the context of the lectures was a dispute, a duel between Manetto and Veneto. So this is actually, so everyone would duel, they have one thing, and then they'd say, so the idea was that people would delight, it's sort of like watching the footy, delight in another team having to go, oh shit, we've lost it, and then finally you turn up in the job queue for sort of thing. And I think your definition, your CV has loser written all over it. So this is duels. They used to have intellectual duels, so Galileo was ready for a duel. The lectures were, in actual fact, a savage attack on Valletta, to the extent that it is difficult to appreciate now. An intellectual career at the Renaissance court consisted of attacks and counterattacks, which often functioned as a kind of spectator sport. This kind of ongoing dispute with reputations on the line was the very stuff of Italian intellectual life, Galileo's. And to an extent, I think this is still true, speaking to Italian friends and the way they speak of people. I do have friends. Oh, look, I've really got no friends, but the closest thing I do have of friends who are Italians do speak of reputations. And, oh, I don't know. Never convinced them. But this was not the point. Rather, he had used his hitherto secret knowledge in successful defence. As noted earlier, Galileo also used the scaling theory defensively in a controversy right at the end as a clincher, so to speak. Thus, it is plausible to be kept for just such a purpose. So, you saw the jewel appearing in a nice way. When Galileo finally published the scaling theory at the end of his life, he hints his story of discovery, including the original naivety about the scale invariance. We have seen how Cicero endorses the scale invariance at the beginning of The New Scientist, but in fact, all three participants do. It's like this. My God, Galileo, you're a genius! On the second day, Simplicio, who is often slow to catch on, suddenly endorses scale invariance as if he'd just thought of it. And there's scientists I know like this who don't get anything, are really stupid, and then they see it, and then it's within about 10 minutes, there's a bit of, I knew it all along. It's just so annoying. At this point, Savarti, who is Galileo's spokesman, says he too had assumed scale invariance once, until various observations showed him to the contrary. In this way, Galileo is commendably frank, truthful, representing his former opinion in the Inferno lecture. On the other hand, he never mentions the lecture itself, which is still to have been awkward for the honour of the Florentine Academy. No one can blame him for this. Quite possibly, by 1638, there was no one alive who even remembered the detail of the original lecture, and there was no real need to recount the story. Thus, motivating problem of new sciences, the collapse of Mantetti's Inferno, was discreetly avoided. And another one, not particularly convincing, a ship that falls apart on its own weight, was invented in its place. In fact, Galileo seems to have regarded the Inferno lectures as an embarrassment, and this may be another reason why he postponed publishing the scaling theory. His first biographer, Vivarti, was unaware of the lectures, despite living in Galileo's house during the last years, collecting Galileo's stories and devoting himself to Galileo's memory after his death. Because Viviani is the source of most stories about Galileo, subsequent biographers have also said little or nothing about the Inferno lectures, which they were only rediscovered in the 19th century. Thus, one could possibly conclude Galileo never told Vivarti about them. Well, I think you can possibly conclude. You can conclude, mate. This circumstance is rather odd when you think that they were very likely a pivotal opportunity that got his career started. A letter from 1594 by Luigi Almani also indicates that Galileo was unhelpful to someone who wanted to get a copy of them. The letter says, about that lecture of Galileo, he's in Padua, and I have not been able to get it from him. There were other copies with Bocco Valori of Florence, including one written in Galileo's own hand, but he apparently did not volunteer this information. So, I don't know. I don't know where one is. Got no idea, mate. Totally lost. Even though he actually hand wrote out his lecture and gave it to someone. Amazing. There is another hint that Galileo's scaling theory was originally planned for defensive purposes. In working out the scaling theory, Galileo would have noticed a second problem in the Inferno lectures besides the inevitable cut to the roof. In the first lecture, the dimensions of the lowest regions are determined by comparison with certain giants who have been placed there by Dante, embedded in the ice. In the lecture, Galileo assumed that these giants had the same proportions as normal men, and his only hesitation on this point was that whether the giants were ideal human proportions favoured by the artist of Albert Dürer, who wrote on the subject, or whether they had proportions more like ordinary men. What? The ideal human or ordinary men? These are only slight difference. So there's the ideal man and the ordinary man. It's sort of like a photoshopped for a magazine. And Manetti and Velo had a different on this point. Gallo favoured Manetti, but in this is a consequence of scaling figures that the giants couldn't have been of either proportions. Ah, okay. So they were having suggestions about what these giants were. So these giants from so these are giants in the place, these forms from ancient, in the ancient world, wherever a giant is mentioned, they were in that hell. So it's given that it is biblical porn, where you can actually just Photoshop in anyone you want, any legend anywhere, you just stuff it in there, sort of like it's like a Christmas special where everyone gets in there, every person, every pope, everyone gets in Dante's hell. It's sort of like this great mishmash of history, the Bible, everything's put together. So all the various giants put in this bottom layer and frozen in Dante's thing. That's enough craziness. So you got these, he's out there lecturing and he's going, oh my shit, they're both wrong, but it can't happen. But it is a consequence of scaling figures that the giants don't have either of these proportions, that it's the ideal or real human. If we look at the New Scientist in the section of the book on scaling of animals, we find that the animals of most concern is man. Galileo is concerned about giant men. He even quotes a poet describing a giant, although not, though it is Aristo, not Dante. He suggests, although it is a rather far-fetched interpretation of words, that Aristotle understands giants would be misshapen. Ah. Now this occurrence, the poetic giants and their proportions in the two New Sciences, is entirely to be expected in the context of the Inferno lectures. Astuto lines make sense as part of a prepared defence. Not only could he be explained the scaling field, he could invoke Astuto as a poet who understands it. Okay, so he's going through the defense of people attacking him. So Dante's got the wrong thing. Now he's now got a second poet who really understands it. It's beautiful. So they've got Dante and Aristo. Although the literary allusion might not impress a scientific audience, the audience that mattered was the courtly audience. And although they would not understand the geometry, they might undoubtedly applaud this trick, just as they applauded his skillful combination of Dante and geometry in the original lecture. Nearly 50 years later, he finally wrote the scaling figure down in a very different audience. These associations still persist. This is speculation, of course, but the reader is invited to find a more plausible explanation of what Asura's giant is doing in the New Scientist. What is this giant doing in the New Scientist? This is brilliant. So he's got another giant in there. So this is really interesting. Captain Dave, page 13. Okay, coming towards the end. The setting in the Venetian arsenal seems to promise practical science. The scene is so effective that it has functioned as credentials of Galileo, since showing him to be a practical man of science right at home with a foreman of the shop floor. This there can be no doubt whether Galileo really was an ingenious or skillful experimentalist, but this opening scene fails to suggest how theoretical work on scaling actually was. The arsenal fades away almost immediately on the first day, never to reappear. Discussion on the second day, when the subject is finally comes to focus, is about beams of regular and circular cross-section, because the aim is geometrical proof, and the result to which the whole development is tending is entirely theoretical and is given to a practical illustration. Namely, anything could break on its own weight if it was sufficiently scaled up. This is consistent, culminating with propositions 7 and 8 on the second day. The proposition 7, for example, quote, among heavy prisms and cylinders of similar figures, there is one and only one which, under the stress of its own weight, lies just on the limit between breaking and unbreaking. So every larger one is able to carry on a cable load and its weight and breaks, while every small one is able to withstand the additional force lending to the brakes. So this is like a mathematical first-year proof. This 17th-century version of an inevitability of gravitational collapse is what the second day is really about. This is where your experiments, say, your engineering laws come in. So that's I suppose interesting. Gee, my head is hurting. And it is noteworthy that Galileo describes no experiments to verify scaling for you. What I was going to say is that if you read Newton's Principia, it's just on the verge, between a dialogue and a modern scientific paper. Like, he describes inevitably his weights of just really poor swinging boxes, where he has a box swinging, and he puts different things inside the box. And he does experiments where you go, this is really, Isaac, that's really unlikely, and it's incredibly sort of mind-numbing to read. Okay. It's noteworthy that Galileo describes no experiments to verify the scaling theory, although experiments like bending on a loaded beam would have been very simple for him, and entirely characteristic of his Padua years. This circumstance suggests that scaling theory is early and had no practical motivation. Okay, so this is... It was something that he was inventing experimentally. The Inferno lectures begin by praising the skill and audacity of those discoverers who have measured the heavens and the full surface of the Earth, and point out how much more difficult it is to know the Earth's interior, where it seems that no one can go and return. Yet, even this Ardante has done. This is implied theme of the lectures, that a geometer can do this too. Isn't that beautiful? So, you can't go into the Earth, but your maths can go into the Earth. By the use of geometry, we see beyond the limitations of our senses, reasoning, and otherwise inaccessible things. This insight is, in a way, the heart of the physics of Galileo came to understand it. Yet, the Inferno lectures, the ideas are almost accidentally as part of a gib of a clever entertainment. Geometry is merely deceptive. There are no actual discoveries. So, which is really interesting, that that this science is sort of fictionalization, sort of a high-quality fictional view. Now, again, reading Dante is something that's going to kill me. It's 13 hours of dramatic reading, 13 hours to listen about this thing, but... Prof Dave, I'm going to do 13 hours of listening to it. So I now know these giants. So human scaling came from giants, and that was the second problem, that Galileo realised that the giant couldn't be an ideal human or an actual human. So there's a difference between those two. There were two there. It had to be something else, and he had to get another poet to go in. And can I remember the name of that second poet? Is it written there? Oh, look, I can't remember the name of that second poet. Let's see. It's a Vanti or something like that. Oh, I don't know. That's so hard. I wish I could remember that man. It is entirely different with scaling theory. Suddenly, the geometry really did give a key to a new discovery, a discovery that Galileo is still proud to claim as his own at the end of his amazing career. This new insight by way of geometry must have come as a wonderful surprise. For all the faith that Galileo and a few other mathematical enthusiasts had geometry, it was, in practice, an everyday tool of the artisan and merchants and not the source of new insights. Archimedes, to be sure, had used geometry in his wonderful way, but no one imagined there could be another Archimedes. It's sort of like no one can imagine there could be another Einstein. The idea is that, and this sort of belief terms in the way we teach things, we teach the Bohr. There was Bohr and there's no Bohr and no more, which is something I'm against. And again, the scaling theories, you know, like I've got a scaling thing, I've got A's thing on scale. I wonder if you can actually do my scaling thing in your lecture. I wouldn't mind that, mate. Okay. For all the faith that Galileo and a few other mathematical enthusiasts had in geometry, it was, in practice, an everyday tool of artisans, merchants, and not a source of new insights. With scaling theory, however, Galileo had something truly new, worthy of comparison with Archimedes, something that validated his faith in geometry and hinted at the wondering successes to come. Looked at this way, Galileo's lifelong reluctance to publish seems more inexplicable, but perhaps this pattern began with experience of the Inferno lectures. He seems to have done his best to make people forget his lectures and keep the scaling theory to himself. What he made public, at least in this case, was the source of the trouble, while that was kept secret as a source of confidence. The unpleasantness of being vulnerable to attack is a lesson that he might have taken to heart then, and viewed his expressed feelings later on the basis of real experience, although without admitting vulnerability in the opening lines of this essay. Galileo frequently claims to have wonderful results that he has not yet revealed, things that he has chosen not to disclose. We know that this is true through much of his career. Apparently, it was true right from the start. So this is the entire thing in terms of that. It's sort of like playing a card game. Remember playing cheat. It's card games, you have to look exposed. If you are a very strong and you publish everything, people can just circle, you know, you're a target. Finally, this is the last paragraph, mate. Finally, it is an irony that the first success of Galileo's mathematical physics, which is close to being the first success of mathematical physics at all, was a response to a problem that was not physical, but rather the collapse of an imaginary structure in a work core of literature. Well, it's almost, as I say, religious porn. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.